Liberalisierung für verbesserte Kontrolle. Als Kerouac das Buch fertig geschrieben hat, zerstreitet er sich mit seinem Freund Cassidy. Als lebendiges Vorbild hat der seine Schuldigkeit getan und wird nicht mehr gebraucht. Die Wege der beiden Männer trennen sich. Jack Kerouac formalisiert die Schreiberfahrung von On the Road in der Technik des Speedwriting, dem Transkribieren eines unter Amphetamineinfluss ausgelösten und auf Tonband aufgenommenen Wortschwalls ohne nachträgliche Änderung. Mit Hilfe solcher Entleerungen schreibt er Buch um Buch. Er ruiniert sich mit dem Alkohol, der ihn beruhigen soll. Neal Cassady, die Brücke der Beat-Literatur zum echten Leben, beginnt nach einer kurzen Phase, in der Allen Ginsberg seine ständigen Ansprachen stenografiert, selbst zu schreiben. Während sich die weißen Blätter unter seiner Hand füllen, entdeckt Cassidy, dass Fahren und Schreiben dicht beieinander liegen. Das Auto fährt selbst, der Autor schreibt selbst. Beides tut sich besser auf Amphetamin. Der Fahrtenschreiber erfindet sein alter Ego aus Maschine und Mensch, den Rennfahrer Joe Hans, ein Bastard, der zu gierig ist, um aufrecht zu sitzen. Weit nach vorn gebeugt rast der Besessener seiner Wirklichkeit hinterher, die ihm längst entglitten ist. Dass Hans die Realität aus den Augen verliert, ist erstaunlich, da er über eine fantastische Wahrnehmung verfügt. Ein Sehvermögen mit der Fähigkeit, schon während des Denkens zu handeln. Eine Reaktionsgeschwindigkeit, die sich als doppelt so schnell wie die aller anderen erweist. Ermöglicht wird sein Tempo durch eine implantierte Sehhilfe, die 50 Bilder in einem einzigen zusammensetzen kann. Die wundersame Prothese, gepaart mit der ihm eigenen Manie, kürt ihn zu seinem eigenen Weltmeister. Weniger technisch beschreibt Neal Cassady das Werkzeug Amphetamin in einem Brief als Mittel zur Selbstbeobachtung, das es ihm erlaubt, sich bis in das Innerste seiner Augäpfel zu vertiefen. Jahre nach seinem Auftritt in On the Road heuert Cassidy unter dem Spitznamen Speed Limit bei dem schreibenden Wunderkind Ken Kesey als Busfahrer an. Der Autor des Verkaufsschlagers Einer flog übers Kuckucksnest will mit der Tour eines ausgedienten Schulbusses, den seine Mitarbeiter zu einem kunterbunten Popmobil aufgemotzt haben, Werbung für sein zweites Buch machen. Der spektakuläre Clou der übers Land ziehenden Kampagne ist eine mit LSD-25 versetzte Flasche Orangensaft im Kühlschrank des Wohnmobils. Bei öffentlichen Acid-Tests verteilen Kesey und seine Mitarbeiter den bewusstseinserweiternden Saft als Versprechen gesteigerter Modernität. Kesey ist erstmals als studentische Versuchsperson bei einem CIA-Experiment mit Hochbegabten in Kontakt mit LSD-25 gekommen. Will er jetzt die Drogenversuche an die Öffentlichkeit tragen? Oder setzt er einfach nur auf Bambule? Einige behaupten, Kesey und der Psychologielehrer und LSD-Missionar Timothy Leary seien als Sympathieträger der Gegenkultur vom amerikanischen Geheimdienst in Langley dazu ausgewählt worden, die Droge von ihren militärischen Vorzeichen zu befreien und als modernes Versprechen in den zivilen Alltag einzuführen. Die Beeinflussung der Bürger mit LSD-25 sollte dann die Grundlage für eine staatliche Bewusstseinsprogrammierung bilden. Ob nun im Auftrag des Geheimdienstes oder im Zuge eines unklar gesteuerten Zeitgeistwechsels, in jedem Fall entsteht ein öffentliches Gespräch über die Umnutzung von Drogen zu Rausch- und bewusstseinserweiternden Zwecken. Ein interessierter Dritter an dieser Entwicklung lässt sich leicht ausmachen. Unterdrückung von Rauschmitteln führt zwangsläufig zu unzugänglicheren Unterwelten, weshalb eine liberale Drogenpolitik im polizeilichen Interesse der auf Kontrolle ausgelegten Gesellschaften liegt. Jede Menge kalt. Schon 1952 kühlt sich die junge Ehe von William Burroughs und Joan Fulmer ab. Der bisexuelle Burroughs hat sich in einen jüngeren Mann verliebt, mit dem er oft für Wochen aus dem Familienleben verschwindet. Fulmer, die allein mit den Kindern Billy und Julie zu Hause hockt, geht es schlecht. Ständiges Benzedrin, inzwischen kombiniert mit Alkohol, treibt sie noch tiefer in ihre einsame Selbstzerstörung. Schon vor dem Frühstück am Rande des Nervenzusammenbruchs beginnen der 27-Jährigen die Haare auszufallen. Es dauert nicht lange, bis die Situation eskaliert. Am 5. September desselben Jahres trifft sich das Ehepaar mit zwei Bekannten, von denen die beiden ein Gewehr kaufen wollen. Um das Geschäft in Gang zu bringen, wird getrunken. Nach dem dritten Glas behauptet der angeheiterte Burroughs, seine Frau und er würden planen, nach Südamerika auszuwandern. Dort wolle er seine Familie als Jäger ernähren. Das würde wohl bedeuten, sie müssten verhungern. Krankheit Vollma. Wütend erwidert Burroughs, er könne beweisen, wie gut er schießen kann. Er fordert seine Frau auf, sich ein Glas auf den Kopf zu stellen. Die tut, wie ihr geheißen, schließt die Augen und wispert, sie könne kein Blut sehen. Im nächsten Moment fällt der Schuss. Das Glas liegt unversehrt am Boden. John Vollma stirbt in der nahegelegenen Rotkreuzstation mit einer Schusswunde in der Stirn. Laut einer Meldung der Presseagentur AP gesteht Burroughs der Polizei zunächst die Wilhelm Tell-Geschichte. Nach einem Gespräch mit seinem Anwalt widerruft er aber das Geständnis und beharrt nun darauf, es sei ein Unfall gewesen, der Schuss habe sich aus Versehen gelöst. Letztlich kommt er mit 30 Tagen Gefängnis und einer Geldstrafe davon. Burroughs, der bei Bedarf ein schielendes Kaninchen aus dem Hut ziehen kann, verwandelt die Tötung seiner Frau über die Jahre zu einer immer weiter verfeinerten Anekdote in seiner schillernden Aura als Gentleman-Junkie. Sein selbstbezogener Nachruf bleibt nicht allein. Bald spukt das dem Beweis der Zielsicherheit ihres Mannes gefallene Damenopfer als Gespenst durch die Werke zahlreicher Männer. Fast so, als hätten die sich gemeinsam dafür entschieden, der Muse ein Nachleben im Text zu schenken. Jack Kerouac literarisiert die Amphetaminkönigin gleich in mehreren Romanen, als Mary Dennison in Town and the City und als June in Vanity of Dulov. Allen Ginsberg begegnet dem Geist von Vollma 4 Jahre nach ihrem Tod im Traum und schreibt danach Howl, ein Geheul über die besten Köpfe meiner Generation, vom Wahn zerstört. Es wird das populärste Gedicht der US-amerikanischen Nachkriegsliteratur und der meistgekaufte Gedichtband des 20. Jahrhunderts. Acht Jahre nach dem Tod seiner Frau veröffentlicht Burroughs mit Naked Lunch die Innenansichten seines Lebens als Junkie im Gewand eines Groschenromans. Von nun an wird der schreibende Witwer nicht müde zu betonen, ohne den Tod seiner Frau hätte er das große Stück Literatur nie schreiben können. wie es sich für ein Beatkind gehört, dessen Pflicht es ist, gelebtes Leben in Text zu verwandeln, verfasst der Sohn Billy mit 19 Jahren während des Aufenthalts in einer Entzugsklinik mit dem Kurzroman Speed seinen Beitrag zur Familienchronik. In dem autobiografischen Roman haut Billy aus dem Haus der Großeltern Burroughs in Palm Beach ab, bei denen er seine Kindheit verbracht hat, und geht nach New York. Dort entscheidet er sich für ein neues Leben im Zeichen der Familie mit Hilfe von Methadrine, einem injizierbaren Methamphetamin der namensverwandten Firma Burroughs Wellcome, versetzt er sich in den Zustand eines andauernden Spacing. Sein Verstand wird abgeschaltet, während die Sinne auf Empfang bleiben. Wieder und wieder dehnt er die Wahrnehmungsblase mit noch mehr Methadrine. Selbstbild als zu spät geborener Obersturmbahnführer im Stechschritt durch seine Wohnung und erklärt Billy ausufernd, wie er den Drogenhandel durch straffene Organisation optimieren wolle. Seinem Zuhörer ist das egal. Entscheidend ist, Hans Methadrine füllt Billys Tage. Tage, aus denen sonst nur Leere gähnt. Jetzt sieht er überall Gesichter. Wohin ich auch blicke, war irgendwer da. Winzige Menschen schliefen in einem Aschenbecher und ein Riese lehnte sich verdrießlich gegen das Chrysler Building. Die Bäume des Washington Square waren mit Gesichtern aus der Vergangenheit gehüllt. Gesichter, die im Winde wehten. Obwohl ich noch sehr jung bin, das Bedrohliche erscheint immer noch besser als die Leere. Thank you. 40 Jahre nach John Vollmers Tod produzierte Regisseur David Cronenberg eine Verfilmung von Burroughs Legende. In Naked Lunch hat sich der Schriftsteller endgültig in seine Sagengestalt verwandelt, die berichtet, insektenäugige Bewohner einer gewissen Zone hätten dem Kosmonauten des inneren Raumes befohlen, seine Frau zu töten, damit sie fortan durch die Texte geistern kann. Rückblickend kann man sich nur schwer des Eindrucks erwehren, der Beat-Generation sei es mehr um die schnellstmögliche Erfüllung ihrer persönlichen Wünsche gegangen, als um politischen Widerstand. In vorauseilendem Gehorsam feierten die Beats in ihrer Besessenheit vom Aufreißen und Reinbeißen genau jene Bedingungen, aus denen sie vorgaben, auszubrechen. In ihrer Besessenheit vom Auto machten sie das größte Freiheitssymbol des amerikanischen Traums für den Kalten Krieg mobil, indem sie dem Individualverkehr Fords Konzept sozialer Kontrolle ein Flair von Wildem Westen einhauchten und schneller fuhren, als die Polizei erlaubte, wobei sie ihre Geschwindigkeit damit verwechselten, sich der sozialen Dressur zu entziehen. So dienten die Beats als Vorbilder für eine neue Form der Mobilisierung immer größerer Teile der Bevölkerung. Die größere Verfügbarkeit der Technologie spiegelte sich in der Gestaltung der Autos. Linien begannen zu fließen und Heckflossen winkten. Geschwindigkeit formte sich in weniger aggressiven Zeichen aus. Hätte ich mal zwei Sätze früher aufgehört, scheiß Ende.
Just Kaputte FM.
Just mixing everything that we can think of.
Kaputte FM. 1. Jänner 2026. Live aus dem Studio von Radio Helsinki. Zusammen mit Hungover. Danke. Erster gemeinsamer Jam. Wahnsinn. Die Texte heute, abgesehen von dem bereits mal gelesenen Drogentext aus dem Negazin, wo ich nur die ersten paar Sätze gelesen habe und ihn ganz drastisch aus dem Kontext gerissen habe. Die Texte ansonsten waren aus dem Buch mit dem naheliegenden Titel Speed. Eine Gesellschaft auf Droge von Hans-Christian Dani, den wir auch schon mal in dieser Sendung hatten mit dem buche. Morgen werde ich Idiot über Kybernetik. Ja, kaputt FM.
Kaputt FM.
Jeden zweiten Donnerstag um 22 Uhr, 22 bis 0 Uhr hier auf Radio Helsinki. Und tatsächlich, man kann Sendungen auch nachhören und die über kaputtfm.noblogs.org sich anhören oder herunterladen oder auch über freieradios.net, freie-radios.net. Auch dort findet man einige ausgewählte Episoden von Kaputt FM in digitalisierter Form.
Kaputt FM.
Just mixing. Just mixing everything that we can think of.
Suit and he goes to this tailor, and the tailor he's very, very famous and takes all the measurements, and then he comes back to fit the suit. Then he puts the suit on, and one arm of the suit is much too sticks out, and so he says, sorry, but something wrong. What has happened, Mr. Famous, whatever? Mm. He said, nothing wrong with the suit. You're standing wrong. Yeah? So you just have to stand like that, and then it fits. Okay. Mm. He moves his arm, and then it looks okay. Mm. Then there is a little bit of part here sticking out. It looks horrible.
Oh, yeah.
And he says, you have to stand. He stands like this. Yeah.
And then he stands like that. Yeah,
so
yeah.
He carries on, and the suit.
The foot started to fit.
Starts to fit.
So perfectly.
He goes into the train, in the metro.
Yeah.
And this man comes up to him, and he says, this suit is from this and this man, and from the famous man. I can see it's made.
Yeah.
He recognizes the suit. He must be a master to make it for such an invalid as you, because he's walking like an invalid. And the suit fits. So this is exactly how it is in life.
Yeah.
I say to you,
it fits.
Okay. Your work. You're not happy with your work. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go to a shrink. Go to the shrink, and he will try to make you fit into your work. You know. So in the end, if you keep on doing all sort of therapies or whatever, you will be an invalid mentally. Not being yourself anymore, and everybody says it's beautiful job you have and everything is fine, but you don't fit in it.
Yeah, but the suit fits. The suit does, but you don't. You do not. Yeah, the suit always fits. But
you got a famous family in Stanford else. University. You got a famous shrink, psycholoog. And he gave a lesson in Stanford University. He said, God, everybody look up to me. And my father, he made it and whatever.
Yeah.
And he didn't feel very good.
Okay.
He didn't feel happy.
Mate.
So he said, what can I do? You know, I've got everything and I'm not happy with it.
Hmm.
So now he's happy. And he's telling people why he was not happy. He was not happy because he didn't fit in it.
Yeah. It's me that didn't fit the suit. The suit fitted me.
Yeah. So was your work as well inside the company.
Listen to this story.
Ramdas.
That people start to
is he still alive?
Justify their actions in terms of profit.
Is he still alive?
Even though it is at the expense sometimes of the enrichment of the infrastructure of the society.
Is he still alive?
The realization of the dream, of the vision. And
not
then
dead
they
yet.
Have to build, an individual
he's
has
not
to
dead.
Build an entire... No. philosophical justification in their mind to be able to handle the fact that their goal has shifted from something which has a social significance to something that has just a personal significance. And they see that what they read in the textbook about idealism of business, and when they get out on the street, they find that the street values are very different.
In order to buy into those street values,
they have to armor themselves in a certain way to do it. And it's that armoring which we're talking about a little bit. Because of this particular group that I'm speaking with,
it
this
is called
not the disenfranchised or the homeless.
Success.
I assume.
It's the full lecture.
Started working in Coney.
Now speeding up.
In
the 26th, 24th, 25th.
Would you mind?
1 hour and 39 minutes.
Extra bunch of material.
Oh, here.
Whoa.
Too, I would have loved to have his plane. Right? Uncle Paul Mellon has 700 million, and his mother has 700 million, and so on. So
listen.
Billy had maybe 20 million. And so Billy bought a little plane, a Piper Cherokee or something, and I was teaching him how to fly. And we were having a wonderful time, and we landed at LaGuardia Airport, and we pulled over to the private parking area. And we were very happy and really enjoying ourselves, and he had made a good landing, and all was well, nice, pretty day. And as we pulled in, we pulled by this big jet, private jet. Billy looked at it and his face fell. And suddenly he was deeply sad. And I said, Billy, what are you so sad about? He said, oh, that's Uncle Paul's plane. And, I mean, he couldn't have one. He couldn't have one. And I could feel that his life was related to Uncle Paul's money, not to his money. I mean... 20 million was nothing to him. He was living in a world of people with 700 million and making himself miserable as a result of it. So that one of more is better.
I got a message.
I saw it as an extreme example.
Now comes the story.
I had a Cessna 172. I would have loved to have his plane. See, it's all relative, you see. Now, I think another thing that you see about success is that it changes the nature of the risk you can take, because as your investment gets greater and as you have a beautiful physical plant and you have all of this, you have to shift ground. A lot of people who have entrepreneurial zeal, you all know that issue about...
Dit is het meest waanzinnig goede groen wat ik ooit gezien heb, weet je dat? Dit is het meest waanzinnig groen wat ik ooit gezien heb. Het goed dat het hier staat.
Changing risk structure that they have to do in order to preserve structure.
Ja, ook, dit is fantastisch. Geen gordijn nodig.
They are willing to play on the edge and they can't pull back to maintain existing institutions.
En die andere, wat is dat?
Dat is een
entrepreneurs of Oneiva Company after they started.
They are all plants when I came living here, except the left
one. Dit
is ook een bijzondere bloem.
Risk-taking level. But there is a feeling for people who start and build success of a narrowing field as they get more successful because of the fact that they can take less risk and that they have more riding in the sense of more responsibility, more people involved, and they start to feel hemmed in and they don't feel
the freedom of the space. Begieten, op gevoel. En dat doe je dan,
geef je water elke dag.
Dat voelt wel droog aan.
The role you've gotten into of being a certain kind of person starts to entrap you. My father told me a story some years ago about a tailor in a Middle Eastern European country.
That's a
Jewish man.
More stories.
So he went to the best tailor in town.
No, it's okay. I'm listening from time to time. Not all the time.
So Zumbag,
listen to the story. Zumbag.
Man came in to try on a suit, and he put it on, and it was beautiful material, no doubt about it. But when he put it on, this sleeve was about 2 inches longer than the sleeve.
That's what you told. This is a story.
He said, I don't mean to complain, but he said, this sleeve is 2 inches longer than this sleeve. Zumbach took a front. Zumbach says, there's nothing wrong with a suit, it's the way you're standing. Stand like this. And he pushes his shoulder down, and the suit then fits perfectly, you see. And the man looks in the mirror, and he sees there's this big bunched up material back here, and he says, Zumbach, would you mind taking that material? My wife hates it when there's that extra bunch of material there. Zumbach says, there's nothing wrong with a suit, it's the way you're standing. And he pushes his head down like this. So finally, the suit is fitting perfectly. And the man leaves with his new suit on. He's afraid to breathe, for fear it won't fit. And he's been completely cowed by Zumbach, and he gets on the bus. And he's standing on the bus, and somebody comes up and says, what a beautiful suit. I bet Zumbach to Taylor made that suit. And the fellow said, how did you know? He said, because only somebody as skilled as Zumbach could fit somebody as crippled as you. Now, the feeling often of role entrapment is that you have gotten into a suit and everybody's saying, what a beautiful suit, what a beautiful suit, except your spine is out of whack and you're feeling inside not the same, not as good. In my rather checkered career, which I guess some of you know, some of the checkeredness of it, there was a point, I remember, when I had become a professor at Harvard and I was a winner in the culture. I mean, I wasn't making any money, but I was a winner. My father, he said to me, he wanted me to be a doctor. And when I became a professor, he says, well, that's fine, but what are you going to do for a living? So, but at any rate, there I was, a professor, and for most people, except my father, I had won. And people treated me with great respect because I was part of a symbolic institution of great, and everything I said, people listened to. And they thought I was wise. And every day I'd go to work, and everybody would reward me all day. And I was teaching human personality and motivation, and Freud, and all the latest stuff. So that if anybody should be happy, it should be me, technically. I mean, if we wise persons knew what we were talking about, why shouldn't I be it? But I go home and I get into the bathtub and I'd be a neurotic mess. And I decided I would feel somehow that it wasn't good enough. I didn't feel fully satisfied inside, and I thought, it must be me. So I went into analysis and therapy. And what I met was a therapist who was wearing another form of Zumbach suit. And he said, He said, I'll tell you what, I'll teach you how to wear my suits, you don't have to wear your suit, which I learned, and then I became a Freudian therapist, and I have this suit on, and then I got a new role model and a new identity, and when people walk down the street, I didn't see people, I saw psychosexual stages, I saw early anal retentives and late phallics and stuff like that. And I got caught in a new set of roles. And it took me until a rather wild Irishman by the name of Tim Leary came along and introduced me to ways of changing my own consciousness that I began to understand that the feeling of malaise that I was feeling in myself, which because everybody around me kept smiling and saying, you won, I assumed was my sickness, was maybe not my sickness, but was a cue to me, a clue to me, that there was another kind of growth lying in store for me. And that maybe that feeling wasn't something to be treated as pathology, but rather something to be treated as something worth exploring. And that did guide the rest of my life. Some of the side effects of success, interestingly enough, one of them is boredom. You've learned a skill that you know how to do very well, and you keep repeating it. It's just like making pizza. I mean, you can be a big deal maker, but it's still the same thing after a while. You know just the ingredients to put the game together, and it worked, and you keep playing the same one over and over again, and you've got a strategy, and it works, and you start to get bored by the finiteness of the game and the finiteness of your role. And the problem is it's working, and it's giving you all the fringe effects, but the thing itself you do every day starts to bore you. And the way people respond to boredom, it's interesting how aversive people experience boredom to be, especially people who have become successful because they are doers. We have a funny distinction between doers and beers. Beers just sit and be. Doers are always doing it. I'll mow the lawn. Here, let me help you. I'll do this. What do you say? Let's go. And their vacations are exhausting. I mean, they come back from their vacation needing a vacation because they are so exhausted because they can't stop doing. Because they got rewarded for doing, and that's the style they have in life. And what happens to somebody that gets bored that's a doer is they just do harder. And they do more. And they keep doing more until if you watch them, it is exhausting to watch a doer being bored. Because they are so busy avoiding the boredom. Because the boredom is so real for them. And that kind of fast action to avoid boredom has connected with it. And the anxiety about seeing the trap that you're in and not knowing how to get out of it, because all your models of how to get out of it were just to do more of it. Can you hear that issue? If I do something and do more, I will get out of it. And that's the one you learned. And then it doesn't feel great, but I'll do more of it in order to feel better out of that one. But after a while, the more you do, the worse you feel, because you're beginning to see the handwriting on the wall that it's not going to do it for you. These are the cues I'm talking to you about that can force growth prior to a trauma, prior to a total breakdown of the system. I think it was Jesus who said, what profiteth a man if he gain the world and lose his soul? We're talking a little bit about that, the idea of more is better and accruing stuff, more stuff, so that your life becomes stuffier and stuffier and you've got garages full of stuff. You want to see my stuff? Come see my... I've got two houses full of stuff. I mean, it's just stuff and stuff and stuff, and it keeps collecting. Because when you feel that bad feeling of boredom or finiteness, then you are absolutely a mark for the advertising industry, which says to you, if you buy this car that's going to give you this certain driving experience, you won't feel that feeling. And they know exactly, they meaning us, I mean, we are the advertising industry too, know exactly what feeling that is you're playing with in advertising. The feeling of I'm not potent enough, the feeling I'm not beautiful enough, the feeling I'm not successful enough, the feeling I'm not happy enough, I'm not free enough, I'm not stimulated enough. The whole idea of more and different is going to be better. It's the idea that something external to yourself is finally going to give you what you want, and that is a basic fallacy. Now, there's just one more that I think that will be familiar to some of you, of these sort of little clues, and that is your relation to time. I think that a number of you, I suspect, see time as your enemy. You see yourself as caught in time, and there's never enough time. I love to do it, but I don't have time. Can't be with you for your birthday, I don't have time. And you feel like you are running against time so much of the time. I mean, I've been in that so often that out of my basically greed, I want more on my plate than I can digest, and then I am running like the rabbit. I can't stop, and I can't do it because I don't have time. And they say that the secret of what we're talking about today is to snatch the pearl of freedom from the dragon time and get into another relation of time so that instead of time using you, you are in another relationship to time, and that's part of what we're going to be talking about today.
Any of
now, finally, a lot of the things that...
Heftige stof.
Yeah. But he's living in a different world. Love, Serve, Remember movie. Path of the Heart. Eric Tolle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the lack of facing death. I listen to these lectures sometimes. And sometimes I listen to the Dalai Lama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. I didn't... I knew he exists, but I didn't realize that I could listen to him. I never looked him up, Ram Dass.
No?
No. Which is strange because
you can you remember the name then?
Yeah, of course.
I cannot.
Ram Dass.
I forget it every time. I cannot remember the names.
I'm quite a forgetter too, but an important person like Ram Dass, it's a question of if you repeat it more, you will remember it.
So you know
easy.
About Timothy Leary.
Yeah, and you're connected to Ram Dass.
He was in a public. The public. Hearing.
Let's have Ram Dass and Timothy Leary talking.
No.
Ram Dass and Timothy Leary.
Public.
Nothing happens on
hearing.
The screen. Nothing happens on the screen. Public hearing. Ram Dass.
Nee.
Timothy Leary. Eén M.
Timothy.
Nee, O. O. M. O. Niet E, maar O. Timothy.
Leary. A. R. Ja.
Wikipedia. Psychologist, ben je ook eens gekomen? Archives, Tim, boom. Harvard years. Trip to time.
Oh, Timothy Leary.
Public hearing. Defense responsible use of LSD.
That's a film.
Okay.
And he gets...
Mm-hmm. History engine.
This is no.
That looks good. That looks good.
Yeah.
The history engine.
Yeah.
Let's forget that is the video, 1960s, YouTube.
Yeah. And he got he had to. I personally was an LSD user for many years. Very much. Most of my ideas come out of that.
Nothing much happens. That's what
I had in the beginning 16 years as a psychologist.
In a white room with black curtains. Go on. Yeah, well, man, we're there. Michelin for the masses.
Silver horses.
ecstasy that man knows, the ecstasy of revelation, seeing that there's more.
Of course, they're always afraid of changing society.
So he had to pay for what he did.
Yeah. A good one.
On June 5th, 1968.
Yeah, stop, man. Not too much.
This is what I was looking for. The hearing.
The leading contender for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination finished a speech and headed off. As he pushed his way through the enthusiastic crowd, gunshots suddenly split the air and he fell to the ground. Kennedy was rushed to a nearby hospital, where doctors worked on him for nearly 4 hours, desperately trying to save his life.
Senator Robert Francis Kennedy died at 1:44 a.m. today, June 6, 1968.
His assassin was Sirhan Sirhan, a 23-year-old Jordanian. But why had he done it, and had he acted alone? 42-year-old Kennedy had been in politics all his life. He had served as Attorney General, making powerful enemies as he cracked down on racketeering and organized crime. Kennedy's staunch support of the growing civil rights movement also earned him the implacable hatred of the conservatives and segregationists in America's southern states. Kennedy stayed on as Attorney General under President Johnson until the signing of the groundbreaking Civil Rights Bill in 1964. Then, to the delight of his followers, Kennedy announced he was running for a Senate seat in New York.
I've decided to make myself available for the nomination of the Democratic State Convention. I have made that decision because I think our country faces a fundamental political choice. Our traditional aspirations for peace and for prosperity, for justice and for decency, are being called into question.
With the support of his younger brother, Edward, he campaigned vigorously and won the hard-fought race. As U.S. Senator, Kennedy became increasingly disillusioned with Johnson's policies, especially concerning the Vietnam War. By 1968, there were fears that he would split the Democratic Party if he ran against Johnson. But Johnson decided not to run again, leaving the field clear for the ambitious young senator. But as Kennedy's campaign gathered momentum, there were powerful vested interests who thought that his liberal views would make him a dangerous president. Early in June 1968, the Kennedy team arrived in Los Angeles. The theme of his speeches were always the same. He called for tolerance, compassion, and justice. Sirhan Sirhan was not interested. He had developed a deep hatred of Kennedy for backing Israel in the never-ending conflicts in the Middle East. As Kennedy finished making what would be his last speech, Sirhan was waiting for him in a crowded, narrow corridor. Sirhan fired, and Kennedy slumped to the ground, mortally wounded. The assassin was hustled away before some of Kennedy's enraged supporters could attack him. He offered no resistance, but refused to give his name. Kennedy's funeral took place a few days later. His brother Edward led the emotional tributes to a man who many thought might well have become a great president.
My brother need not be idealized.
The good ones got killed, eh?
Large in debt beyond what he was in life.
Yeah, but he's one of the family, eh?
Simply as a good and decent man.
He's a good one.
Are they?
Are they really? I think Robert Kennedy was the good one. He was looking for decency. But the people who were undecent killed him. They were afraid they were losing their indecency.
Sirhan was sentenced to life imprisonment. This was at a later parole
for him,
hearing,
this
he
was
said he bitterly
true.
Regretted what he had done and thought he should be released.
We go on this case as a straight homicide without consideration of the identity of the victim. Then I feel that I eminently qualified to be paroled,
But unfortunately for Sirhan, no one will ever forget that he had murdered one of the most prominent men in America.
Je zou eigenlijk gewoon wat tabak moeten gaan kopen, Theo. Jezus, man. Dit is best een beetje gruis dit, hoor.
It is a unique experience that African Americans have had in the military in America.